Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Thank you for tuning in. My guest tonight is Randy Hurlbert. He's actually calling all the way from Thailand. Randy, are you there?
I am here. I can hear you loud and clear.
Awesome. It's amazing the modern technology that we have nowadays, isn't it?
I know it is, and it is the other side of the world. It's Tuesday morning here, 11 o'clock, and I'm looking out my 26th-floor window at the major vista view of the river that runs through Bangkok.
Wow. I have never been to Thailand. It's one of the places, that and Japan. I've got a couple of places on my wish list.
Well, it's a wonderful place. The people are very warm and friendly. The weather's warm. Actually, I'm going to take a little side trip to Singapore this coming weekend. I haven't been to Singapore yet, so I'm kind of looking forward to that.
Oh, good for you. Good for you. I have a friend, actually, who lives in Bangkok and is teaching English as a second language. So.
Ah, good thing.
So
I'm learning Thai. I've been visiting here and spending significant time here for the last about 8 years, and my Thai is getting every year a little better, but it's a very difficult language to learn.
So I've heard. The food's really easy to warm up to, though.
Say that again?
Thai food?
Oh, yeah, Thai food is very good.
It's to die for, if you ask me.
Yeah, right, exactly, every day.
Really good. So for our listeners who don't know who you are, Randy, let me introduce you a little bit, and you can come behind and say more if you want. But
absolutely.
Randy is an internationally acclaimed relationship coach, a speaker, and an author. He specializes in helping singles and couples overcome commitment phobia. I want to come back to that in a minute. You're the author of two books, Partners in Love and Crime, and also another book called Love is Not a Game. And you're a member of the Relationship Coaching Institute, a certified relationship coach, a certified interaction management instructor, and a member of the Independent Writers of Southern California. Does that wrap it up, or is there some more?
Well, that pretty well wraps it up in a nutshell, but, you know, maybe I can explain how I got into this and
a little bit
about my books.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I mean, I think, don't most people think that relationship phobia is kind of a gender-specific thing? Like, don't we usually tend to associate that with men, or am I mistaken?
Well, commitment phobia is usually associated with men, but I think that it's a broader thing than that. I think that it's basically a fear that most people have of relationships and not getting their needs met. And this is sort of the whole focus of my second book, which is the Partners in Love and Crime book, that people get into relationships for a lot of reasons. We can discuss those. But they want to get their various needs met, and they have a lot of needs. And what they have found through bad experiences is that oftentimes they don't get all their needs met, and so they hang back from relationships. And some people call this commitment phobia, but what it really is a natural fear that people have. And the solution is not to say, okay, you know, get over your commitment phobia, but the solution is to figure out how to get needs met in a relationship.
Oh, I like that. I like that because I know I'm always thinking, oh, I have a fear of intimacy, and then that just makes me feel like there's something wrong with me.
No, I think everybody has a fear of intimacy. I have an article that I wrote several years ago called The Moth and the Flame, and it's one of my favorite articles because it's so true, and you know how the moth comes in closer to the flame because it wants the light and the warmth and whatever, but then as it gets too close, it starts to get hot and so moves away from the flame. And this is sort of the dance that happens in almost every relationship. And, you know, some people can stand the heat a little more than others.
Yeah. Well, and needs are changing, don't you think? I mean, I don't know, when my grandparents got married, you know, my grandmother was born in 1899. My dad was the 11th out of a long line of kids, so his oldest brother was 20 years older than him, so that means my grandmother was about 20 years older than most grandparents for my age bracket. But when she got married, they were just interested in who was going to be able to bring in the money and who's going to be able to cook. And in their case, she and my grandfather built a log cabin together with their own bare hands. So, I mean, that was a totally different need set. You didn't hear them talking about things like, oh, the passion is gone, or he doesn't understand me. But don't you think our needs have changed over time?
Well, I think that the priorities have changed over time because life back then was more difficult. In some ways it was more simple, I suppose. But, you know, the importance of marriage and a partner in order to simply share the chores, you know, was even more important then than it was now, although sharing chores continues to be an important reason that people get married, you know, just because being a single parent is so difficult. But, you know, as our standard of living has risen and life gets easier in some ways, why, you know, people start to think about things that they didn't think about before. Like you say, you don't understand me, and they want to get their ego needs met, and they want to feel closeness in the relationship, and they're not satisfied any longer with just one person makes money and the other cooks.
No, I don't think so. Hey, so I'll bite. How did you get into this line of work?
Well, I got into it, as I suppose many do, by the school of hard knocks. I was married, had a couple of kids, and you know, I thought it was the perfect American family until it sort of came apart from the inside out. And then I was out in the dating world and trying to figure all this out and finding things that didn't work, and read all the different books and still wasn't working. And I wound up, fortunately, in my perspective, coming across a psychologist by the name of Harold Bissell. And he turned my head around. Everything that I was reading in the books wasn't working, and I came to understand why, and ultimately he was the collaborating psychologist on my first book, which is The Love Is Not a Game Book. And I would like, here at the right point, to describe the picture of relationships that he was able to give me that helped so much in my own understanding, and that I describe in that book, Love Is Not a Game.
Well, I think a lot of people think love is a game, so I'd love to hear more about that.
Well,
how is it not a game?
In some ways it is a game. The title actually was chosen because I describe my concept and Dr. Bissell's concept of a relationship in terms of four dice. And so dice is typically thought of as a game, but I remember one time when I was explaining this to a female friend of mine, she said, "Oh, but love is not a game." And so I chose that title to sort of differentiate between the fact that I'm using these four dice, which I can explain to you here in just a second, for the four key ingredients of love, and to differentiate that from its being a game, because, you know, I don't really think it's a game. So let me tell you about the four ingredients of a good love relationship, and then I'll explain how the dice fits in.
Okay.
And this is what I learned from Dr. Bissell, and what is so basically important. And it is that when one person goes into a relationship, they go in wanting love, but love is a mixed up thing. and it consists of the chemistry that I feel for you, the chemistry that you feel for me, the ability that I have to treat you well, and the ability that you have to treat me well. So there's the feeling content, which I'm using the term chemistry, but I don't just mean sex and I don't just mean infatuation. I mean that feeling of enjoyment that you have with another person. But my feeling for you and your feeling for me might be different. Usually are to some degree. And the other piece of this is the ability to handle a relationship, and that's what Dr. Bissell calls emotional maturity. And my emotional maturity and your emotional maturity are, whatever they are, most likely different. And what happens in relationships is one person feels more than the other, one person is more mature than the other, and these differing factors create the dynamics of a relationship. And so then I describe these in terms of four dice, the dice being, if you can picture red color, so I've got two red dice for the chemistry, like Valentine hearts, you know.
Uh-huh.
And two white dice for the emotional maturity, which you think good guys, white hats, that's why I chose white. And so you can measure chemistry on a scale of 1 to 10 or 1 to 100, or in the case of dice, 1 to 6. And you can measure emotional maturity on any scale you choose, but for my book, I chose 1 to 6. And then using these four dice, two reds for the chemistry that he feels and the chemistry that she feels, and two whites for the emotional maturity that he has and that she has, you can describe any relationship. So the best relationship would be four sixes. Both have very high chemistry for each other, and both have very high emotional maturity, and that's what I call a soulmate.
So, how do you define emotional maturity? I'm sure everybody wants to fit in that category, and you have some kind of, unbiased way of assessing that?
Absolutely, and again, I learned from Dr. Bissell. I learned
is this
most
in your
of what
book,
I know,
by the way?
Quite frankly, from Dr. Bissell, and he has a questionnaire called the Emotional Maturity Questionnaire that contains about 60 questions that you can ask yourself about another person. So you say to yourself about this other person, for example, one question is, my friend is able to express his feelings easily and accurately. And you answer that question on a scale of 1 to 5, with a 1 being, you know, almost never, and a 5 being almost always. So on a scale of 1 to 5, my friend is able to accurately and easily express his feelings. Another one is my friend is able to accurately assess the feelings of others and respond appropriately. So that's, you know, a similar question because it has to do with feelings, but it's different because it's the ability to assess and respond to another person. So there's 60 questions like this, not all about feelings. You know, some of them are like my friend makes and keeps his promises. So you can rate that on a 1 to 5.
Uh-huh.
And another one would be my friend behaves in planful ways. Let's that on 1 to 5. So this
so what it,
emotional.
So, okay, so anyway, we obviously can't go through all 60, but
no.
If somebody's reading your book, do you have all 60 of them in the book, or are you recommending that couples take these tests together? How does it work?
Well, in the Love Is Not a Game book, the questionnaire is in the appendix. There's also a questionnaire that measures the chemical attraction that I mentioned.
Chemical attraction? Well, that sounds interesting. What is the chemical attraction?
Well, the chemical attraction is the enjoyment that you have with a person. And the important thing that Dr. Bissell taught me, and it's in my book, is to be able to differentiate this chemical attraction from the emotional maturity. So the questions on the chemical attraction questionnaire are things like, I can forgive this person almost instantly, and you rate that from 1 to 5. Or, you know, there is something almost mystical in our eye contact, and you rate that on a 1 to 5. So this questionnaire, when you get finished doing all the questions, helps you see how much chemical attraction you have for another person. And it's not a matter of being, you know, I'm in love or I'm not in love. It's a matter of how much feeling is there and how much enjoyment. And I'm not talking again about sex. I'm talking about the feeling.
Okay.
And what happens to people in relationships is they get pulled into the relationship by the chemical attraction. And if it's high, at least for one person, they get pulled into the relationship. And they believe that it's going to be good because they project everything that they want in a relationship onto the other person. But then as time goes on, they find out how the person treats them, which is the emotional maturity side, and it often isn't quite so pretty.
So what do you recommend? I mean, that chemical attraction, that's pretty powerful stuff, huh?
It's absolutely quite very powerful stuff. And I don't recommend abandoning chemical attraction, but I recommend balancing chemical attraction with emotional maturity and deciding how much of each you want and how much you can stand. Because a lot of chemical attraction, let's say a 6 on a scale of 6 using my dice, with low emotional maturity, let's say a 3 on a scale of 6 using my dice,
yeah,
is bound to be painful.
Oh, so you can actually take this test and kind of figure out if you're going to have more fun than heartache?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You can figure out whether you have more fun than heartache. I like that.
You can borrow it. So,
yeah, I got to write this down.
Write that one down. More fun than heartache.
More fun than heartache.
that's very interesting. Now, what about, do you find that some people have different priorities? Like some people maybe will make a legitimate choice to have the, you know, a higher quotient of chemical attraction, even though it's going to create a little bit of pain? And do you think that's a valid choice if somebody decides to do
that? That's a valid choice for someone to make, that they're willing to put up with a certain degree of heartache because they get this chemical attraction. And then there's another important aspect to this, which is that the emotional maturity part of it is a learned skill and can grow and improve over time. Now, that doesn't say that it will. Most people sort of top out at about a 4 on my scale of 6. But it can grow from a 3 to a 4, and with work and patience, from a 4 to a 5, and even to a 6.
And that can be a kind of a stumbling block for some people who think they can work on their mate and improve on them, don't you think?
Well, it is possible to do.
Oh.
But it isn't something that you can do easily, quickly, or painlessly. And I don't recommend doing it unless you are, you know, committed to that relationship and, you know, want the feelings that you get from it and, you know, are willing to do the work necessary to see it through, part of which entails uncertainty because it may or may not happen.
Wow. Okay. So this almost seems like this book, Love is Not a Game, actually is kind of a way to analyze and manage your risk.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's kind of like a very logical way to go about deciding if you really want to be in a relationship and why you're there and what kind of obstacles you might encounter along the way.
Exactly. And so one of the things that it helps you to determine, and like you say, manage your risk, let's say you decide that you have some relationship which is high chemical attraction but low emotional maturity, which has quite a bit of heartache and not too much certainty and don't know whether it's really going to grow or not, you know, you might decide that you don't want to put all your eggs in that basket. And so you might decide that you want to have, you know, a couple of different baskets to share your eggs around in, so that, you know, if this one falls through, which it might,
right,
you'll lose all your eggs. So dating several people at the same time is something that, you know, it depends on the situation, but is not something that should be frowned on, in my opinion.
Do you ever advise people to, I don't know, to, like is there a certain threshold where you would say this is a dysfunctional choice or a destructive choice? Or are you basically, you know, here's what you may produce by this particular action, and whatever you decide is, you know, if it works for you, great.
Well, there certainly are thresholds. They may tend to be individual, so I would work with a person to determine what their individual thresholds are, but let's just say, generically speaking, someone who is a 2 on a scale of 6 on emotional maturity would be someone who is showing abusive behavior, and, you know, it's highly unlikely that that person is going to grow up very quickly. And so, you know, I would not recommend staying in a relationship where there's abusive behavior. And, you know, abusive is covers a range of ills, so, you
know,
there's degrees of abuse. But, you know, if it's really abusive behavior of any kind, I'd say get out of it. But, and for the most part, a 3 on this scale of 6 is sort of, you know, pretty immature. It's not abusive, but it's a long way to go. And so for most people, I would not recommend hanging in there with a 3 unless they're willing to get help and get assistance to do it, because it's just too difficult. So then you're talking about the 4s, which is the majority of adults. And there, you know, it's a matter of the relationship is okay, it's got problems, and then we can talk about how to resolve issues and get needs met in a basically adult manner, although, you know, there's still deficits in maturity that need to be worked on.
So it's, you know, this sounds mostly like a monogamous model, like you would just want to find one person to be in a relationship with, but do you ever work with people who are in polyamorous situations where they have more than one partner?
Yes, I do. And in fact, my second book, the Partners in Love and Crime book, is, it's sort of halfway between a monogamous model and a polyamorous model. It's Partners in Love and Crime, the model there is to have a primary relationship, which is the central relationship, but where the two partners are helping each other get all of their needs met. And, you know, these needs can be everything from simple things like, you know, understanding and, you know, work with the chores, etc. But it gets into the deeper question, I call them secret needs, of things like variety. So
right,
there you're talking, you know, your polyamory thing. Needs for control and sexual fantasies and, you know, a whole variety of things that I discuss in my Chapter 9 on secret needs. But in terms of your question on polyamory, the book is not devoted to polyamory, but it does include outside sexual relationships within the context of a primary central relationship and helping each other get those needs met in whatever ways the two people agree to. And it can be anything from flirting to threesomes to, you know, going out and, you know, finding professional sex workers, whatever, you know, turns out to work for the particular couple and keep them from feeling like they're in prison. That's
yeah,
where the
name
of the
book
comes from.
Is titled Partners in Love and Crime? I was just going to ask you about that. What's the crime part?
Well, the crime part is, you know, getting out of prison and helping each other break the rules, the societal customs and conditioning that make us feel like we're in prison. And people, get into relationships, and they get into monogamous relationships because it's the thing to do, it's what we're programmed to do, and then they wind up feeling like they're in prison, and so they have to break out, and they either break up with their boyfriend or girlfriend, or they get a divorce, and then they get back into another monogamous relationship because it's the thing to do, and then they feel like they're in prison. And so the end crime part is to break the rules of social conditioning to help each other get out of prison.
So you're basically saying that instead of going sneaking behind your partner's back, you know, that you're going to work together as a team to find solutions to the things that aren't working. So and again, you're really focused on people getting their needs met.
Right.
So there's probably some people who say, don't be so selfish, you don't need to get all your needs met. Have you ever run into that?
Well, people say a lot of things.
There's some people who would say that if you needed to go have sex outside the relationship, you're being selfish.
Oh, absolutely. Everybody says that just about.
Well, then tell me what it is you say in defense of going outside the relationship.
Well, first of all, I have to talk to an individual person and their situation, and you and I are talking generally, and, you know, I don't start with that at the outset with someone who is just trying to learn about relationships.
Right.
And I think that the solution for individuals is a gradually evolving understanding of the other person and learning to share what their needs are and finding out that it isn't a matter of being selfish. It's a matter of this is how many people are. In fact, I think that people were, what's the other word? The opposite of cultural conditioning is genetic conditioning. I think our genetic conditioning tends towards promiscuity. Promiscuity, I can't speak straight.
Right.
Our genetic conditioning is more towards promulgation of the species, variety, and
Gene
pool. And there's plenty of research out there, some of which I quote in my book, that indicates this is the genetic conditioning that people have. So it's not just a selfish need. It is, in fact, a very basic primal need. And two people, in order to have a successful, intimate, close relationship, in my opinion, need to be able to at least discuss it and recognize it for what it is, and then how they solve it depends on the two of them, and whether they solve it by, you know, just lots of talk, or they solve it by porn movies, or they solve it by threesomes where they're all present, or they solve it with other things where they're not always present together, is up to them, as long as it works as a solution that does in fact deal with the underlying genetic conditioning.
So we were talking a little bit about stereotypes about gender, and I'm just wondering, if you have, are some of your premises more popular with men than with women, or have you even found any gender differences as far as people who kind of gravitate towards your work?
Well, you know, there's a weird dichotomy there because women tend to gravitate more towards relationship issues and relationship coaching and reading books and understanding relationships, where men are probably more likely to believe in things like, you know, variety and, you know, sexual opportunity and et cetera, et cetera. And I think that the genetic conditioning, we were just talking about genetic conditioning towards variety, I think that that is more a male genetic conditioning, and I think the female genetic conditioning is more towards security and bringing up children and that sort of thing. You know, it's part of their gene pool, and this is what most of the scientific research that I've seen anyway suggests. So I think men and women do come from a different place in terms of their underlying primal conditioning, and then, you know, they have to get it all sorted out in their adult life.
Yeah. Of course, I'm going to disagree with you, but, you know, I'm entitled to do that. I just, you know, they've actually done some studies on these little birds where the female birds establish a nest with a mate who they consider to be suitable to raise their young with, so that they choose him specifically because he'll be good with the young birds and he'll be a, you know, a good provider and help them build the nest and everything. But then they go off behind his back and get their eggs fertilized by some other guy. and they are finding that pattern more and more in a lot of different species. So, you know, this one little bird has come up in the studies, but it's starting to kind of...
The other one that I heard in terms of bird research was that a female bird will choose a male bird that has the best possible territory and, you know, food providing opportunities, and if there's a male bird that has more providing opportunities, he may be able to attract several female birds that will choose to have more provisions rather than a monogamous relationship, so to speak.
I think it's quite interesting that they've actually been finding out that a lot of females who looked like they were being monogamous were actually sneaking behind the back of their mate.
And this is what happens in real life, I think, more often than we like
maybe
to admit.
People say they want
monogamy, they get married into a promise of monogamy, and then they go off behind the scenes.
Exactly. I was going to say, maybe the birds need your book. Learn how to stop lying.
Exactly, and, you know, it's how to stop lying, but most people can't stop lying because they can't accept the truth of the inner condition, the truth of the other person's inner needs and inner secrets, and because they can't accept it, you know, they keep on lying.
Now, didn't some of your work come out of the idea that men and women see each other as the enemy instead of partners?
Well, there is that in it, and I do mention that in my book, but that's not a basic tenet of my book. My basic tenet is that men and women don't understand each other or themselves. And this basic misunderstanding of who they are at a primal level, who the other person is at a primal level, and their basic misunderstanding of love relationships and how they operate, you know, just creates a bunch of dysfunction.
Well, wouldn't you agree one of the big obstacles to knowing yourself is just, you know, the fear of finding out that you don't conform to what you think you should?
Absolutely.
How do you help people, like in Partners in Crime, is it Love is Not a Game? Which one of those books do you think is stronger as far as helping people get past that shame and start dealing with how they really are as opposed to what they think they should be?
Probably Love is Not a Game is more oriented towards that.
Okay. And what kind of tools?
I'm sorry, I misspoke. Partners in Love and Crime. Right.
Can you give our listeners some tips on, because, you know, this show is all about busting shame. This is a shame-free zone. Can you give our listeners a few tips from your book about how you get past that crushing sense of shame that drives a lot of us to deny our true feelings to ourselves even?
Well, of course, the first step is to read the book, because the book goes through a lot of these basic needs that people have, and so it's to, A, get the book, B, read it, and most importantly, read it with an open mind as opposed to just shutting everything out that you read when it doesn't agree with, you know, your preconditioned notions.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a diagram here that's in front of me in my Chapter 9 about secret needs, and it's called the Chain of Deterioration, and so I have this picture of a chain with various links in it, and I'm going to tell you that the way sex leads to deterioration in a relationship, and it kind of, you know, goes to what you're talking about in terms of getting over shame, etc. And the reason that sex leads to deterioration goes as follows. That, you know, first there's sex, that's the first link in this chain. But the second link in this chain is we have all of these taboos. So, you know, there's taboos about how you can do it and how you can't do it and what time you should do it and, you know, certain acts that are okay and other acts that aren't okay and, you know, what you can talk about. And so there's all of these taboos that are programmed into us by society. And the third link in the chain is that, you know, we don't accept our partner because of our taboos. And as a result of these taboos, mostly against sex, we don't accept our partner. So that non-acceptance then leads to the next chain link in this chain, which is an emotional distance. So because we don't accept a partner and his or her desires, whatever, we become more emotionally distant. And as we become more emotionally distant, the next link in the chain is we raise up barriers. And then the next link after we raise up these barriers is alienation. And the final link after that alienation is the deterioration. So we have this series of events from sex to deterioration. And the key link in that chain, the one that needs to be beefed up or broken to break this chain, is the link of non-acceptance. Because, you know, desire for sex is there, the taboos are there in the society, and if you continue with non-acceptance, then the emotional distance, the barriers, the alienation, and deterioration will happen. So the place to work is on the non-acceptance and to come to a better understanding, and it's through reading books and doing relationship coaching or counseling or therapy or whatever, because it's hard to get past this stuff all by yourself.
Well, absolutely it is. You also talked, when I was on your website, which, by the way, we should probably mention, is partnersinloveandcrime.com. Partnersinloveandcrime.com. Went over to your website. And you talk about anger or shock over a recent affair. And there is a solution. But first you need to know the hidden cause of these relationship breakdowns. What, you know, and obviously, it goes without saying that people need something more than what they can get off a radio program, but we are a radio program. So for the purposes of the radio program, what can you say about the anger or shock that people experience about an affair that their partner may have had?
Well, first of all, the anger and shock is very real and very painful and, you know, should not be downplayed in any way, because, you know, when it does hit, it's, you know, extremely difficult to deal with, especially because it comes as a surprise. And, you know, that's where I, you know, try to help people defuse these things gradually over time instead of waiting until it hits with a surprise. And I want to describe from, I guess, Chapter 4 of my Partners in Love and Crime book, a downward spiral that is described in another book that is by Karen Horney, who's a psychologist. But this downward spiral comes as a result of these inner conflicts that we've talked some about, and it starts with the overestimation of love. So people have an overly high expectation of what love can accomplish for them, and when it doesn't meet those expectations, it leads to disillusionment. So one of the first steps is to, you know, bring your expectation down to reality and not, you know, stay in the fairy tale world. Then the second one is that the partners tend to want to possess each other. And the desire for possession and control conflicts with the other person's desire for freedom, and so they want to escape. And then third we have what we just talked about, which is the taboos against sex, which result in unfulfillment. And so what you have is that the disillusionment because of expectations that are too high, the desire to escape because of the control and possessiveness, and the unfulfillment because of taboos, results in this hostility and alienation, cause people to, you know, be secretly hating each other, and then they go out and have an affair. And so
it makes you wonder how we ever get together at all.
Yeah, but the affair is, you know, people blame the affair and say, you know, because he had an affair, I hate him. But the truth of the matter is that the hate occurred prior to the affair. And it occurred because of this alienation, and it occurred because of the disillusionment. And so,
that's,
you know, this is why I wrote
point.
My books, because all the other books that I was reading out there, you know, there's a lot of information there and some good information, and I don't discount them, but it wasn't getting to the heart of the matter.
So basically what you're saying is that by the time you get to an affair, you are looking at a symptom of...
Absolutely, absolutely.
It's a symptom of the relationship, not this strange anomaly that has taken a perfectly good relationship and ruined it.
Right, it's a symptom of the relationship issues, and it's a symptom... You know, well, you have to get into an individual situation to find out if it's a symptom of people got married too soon and it really wasn't true chemistry, go back to my chemical attraction thing, and if it wasn't really true chemistry of a sufficient degree, then a person will feel unfulfilled and go out and have an affair. Or
now, why do you think somebody would go into a relationship when they don't have any chemical attraction?
It happens all the time.
Well, give me one example.
It happens because we want a relationship so much that we jump into one before we really know what the attraction is. And there's a lot of false positives on this attraction business. And the false positives, the most prime among them, are beauty, money, and charm. So, you know, if someone is beautiful or handsome or charming or rich, you know, we perceive that then as attraction in some way, and we get into the relationship, and then we find out that, you know, hey, we actually don't really enjoy that person as a person. But by the time we figure that out, we've already made certain commitments, we've had sex, maybe we've gotten married, and, you know, then it's kind of too late, and we feel guilty and all that stuff.
Wow. How do you sort that out? How do you sort out? I mean, I'm sure a lot of people think they're attracted to somebody who's beautiful. That seems kind of to make sense, don't you think?
Well, the way you sort it out is, you know, two important things come to mind quickly. One is to use the romantic attraction questionnaire that I described that helps you to assess it. And the other is to wait a long enough period of time to get past the infatuation stage where it's all in your imagination, and that typically is at least 3 months of frequent contact. So in the first month or two, you know, everything is imagination, and it's all great and wonderful and beautiful, and, you know, usually people have sex in that period of time, and they start to want exclusivity in that period of time, and it's simply too soon. So you need to get past that three-month point.
Okay, can you talk a little bit about, because, you know, almost everybody does internet dating now where they meet people online and then maybe they start talking to them over the phone before they ever meet them in person. I've done that. I mean, I got divorced 4 years ago, and so I tried out the internet dating thing, and it seems to me that there's a bit of a disconnect when we meet somebody over the internet. So I'm just wondering, does your three-month rule apply to being in person, or does
yes,
it apply
it's
to...
Yes, it's in person.
Huh?
3 months of frequent in-person contact. Internet contact doesn't count.
Can you tell our listeners why internet contact doesn't count?
Well, internet contact has no personal, biophysical, chemical interaction to it. It has only the intellectual contact of words and pictures, and, you know, forgetting the fact that people can put up pictures that aren't them and use personas that aren't them. I mean, there's that to deal with, but, you know, even someone who is legitimately looking for a relationship, the internet is a fine way to come across other people who are single and looking, and to get some amount of understanding about common interests. But it will not tell you much at all about true chemistry, and it will not tell you much at all about emotional maturity. And so you have to use internet for what it is, which is just a way of finding someone with whom you can then meet them in person, and then you have to meet them in person frequently for at least a few months before you get past the infatuation stage.
I think that is such an important piece of information, but it's probably also really important to me because I messed up last year thinking that I could learn a lot over the telephone and the internet, and the person did not misrepresent themselves in the slightest, and there was still just this element, like you're saying, the chemistry that you do not know about until you're in the same room with that person.
That's right, and I don't know how many people, you know, have built up a whole big fantasy picture in their mind over the phone and over the internet, and then they meet in person, and it's just, you know, the whole bubble bursts.
And if people are prone to building fantasies in person, even, where you got to wait 3 months after personal contact before you can get past your fantasies, I think it's even much more seductive to be living a fantasy over the internet.
Yeah, people live in this fantasy over the internet for years sometimes.
Yeah, and that is really a trend now where people are not, especially for younger people, they're just not inhabiting the same room.
Right.
So, very interesting. 3 months, huh? To get past, months.
Well, that's 3 months, and, it would be best to be doing that in a conscious way so that you know what you're doing during those 3 months.
Would you advise people not to have sex in those first 3 months or to have lots of sex during those first 3 months?
Frankly, what I advise is what I call progressive sex. You know, I think it's hard to withhold sex for 3 months. I don't necessarily disagree with withholding it, but, you know, and nowadays it's probably difficult to do. But you don't have to just jump in and have everything all at once. You know, you can move from holding hands to kissing to petting to, you know, all the teenage stuff, I guess some people would call it, but you know, it's always kind of good to have something left out in front to look forward to.
Oh, I like the way you think. I do. I was like, God, I think the whole hugging, kissing, necking thing, I mean, that is something that, you know, when you're young and I guess you're afraid to have sex or you don't have opportunities to have sex, you spend a lot of time doing that. And I've talked to a lot of people who, that was like some of the hottest sex of their life was before they got to have sex.
Yeah, and you know something else that's just that's very powerful and almost as powerful as sex, I debate myself which is more fulfilling, and it's just sleeping together, no sex.
Yes.
You know, just the act of sleeping together with someone, you know, you kind of get a certain feeling about the person in terms of how protective you feel and how warm they feel and cuddly, and you know, there's kind of a lot in there that reads between the lines.
There really is. There really is. And I think it's so important. I really do. We're about up as far as our time goes here. I want to give you an opportunity to mention the websites and your books again and the ways that people can contact you.
Well, the website is partnersinloveandcrime.com, and you can, you know, read all about me, see my picture and everything there. And on the products page, it tells you about the two different books and some audio programs that I have available. And they can email me at randyh@partnersinloveandcrime.com.
And, I really want to get my hands on those 60 questions that you have to answer to find out whether or not you have emotional maturity in the relationship. That's very intriguing.
Well, I'll send those to you by email.
Oh, thank you. Now I could really use that. I've been kind of frustrated with some of my choices in the last 4 years since my divorce. Seems like I forgot how to shop.
Yeah, I will send you those by email, and anyone buying either one of my books actually will be able to download them. They're in the appendix to Love Is Not a Game, which is a hard copy book, a paperback book. But if you buy that book, I also, you know, you download electronic copies of the questionnaires. If you buy the Partners in Love and Crime book, that is an e-book, so you download it instantaneously to your computer right then and there when you buy it, and it comes with the two questionnaires also as downloads.
Awesome. Randy,
and in fact, the people who want to buy the Partners in Love and Crime book comes with a one-hour phone consultation with me. We can talk directly about their personal situation.
Oh, there you go. There you go. That sounds even better. Randy, I can't thank you enough for being so generous with your time and for calling us from Thailand, of all places. And I'm very excited about this material. I'm especially excited about the fact that you're creating choices for people so that they can make their own decisions about what's best for them. I think that's awesome.
It is. You know, there's stuff in both of these books that you just can't find anywhere else, and I quote a lot of research from other books that I think is also helpful, so it's just not all my own ideas.
Very great. Well, thank you so much for doing your part to eliminate
shame. It's been
fun,
Veronica, and do you tape it? Can you send me a tape or a download?
We definitely will get that to you.
Okay.
All right, great. Randy. Thank you so much.
Okay, good to talk to you, Veronica.
Take care.
Okay, bye.
Veronica Monet offers help, healing, and hope in the form of private telephone sessions. Email veronica@sexwithoutshame.com to schedule an appointment, or visit www.sexwithoutshame.com to find out what Veronica can do for you.